Hey everybody, Michael Thiessen here. And today on Open Mic with Michael Thiessen, we are talking with a good friend of mine, James Kitchen. And just before James comes on and gives us a tremendously important update, I want to explain the connection between Open Mic with Michael Thiessen and Liberty Coalition Canada. Basically, what we've got are two shows being developed, and the one show is Liberty Dispatch, where we really want to be very careful that we're staying on Canadian current analysis news articles. You know, we want to do all of that together. And that show is growing in its cast. We're bringing on, obviously, Tim Tyso is with us. I'm going to be on a little bit less frequently over the next number of months. And we're bringing on Matthew Halleck and a good guy named Andrew DiBartolo. And the reason why I've started this secondary podcast called Open Mic with Michael Thiessen is because this is really, I enjoy intelligent conversation. To be more specific, I enjoy having intelligent people speak to me so I don't have to read books. And so really, my podcast was birthed with the idea that I would listen to individuals and interact and ask good questions. And I'm going to really hone in on that. But today, Liberty Coalition Canada and Open Mic with Michael Thiessen really converge. And this is going to happen quite frequently because we are interviewing our chief litigator for the Liberty Coalition Canada, Mr. What do we call Esquire James Kitchen Esquire? Is that the appropriate legal term for a lawyer?
No, I think that might be an American thing. Definitely nobody does that in Canada.
Okay, well, let's go with the American thing because we want to give you something. I can't just call you Mr. James Kitchen. It's got to be James Kitchen
Esquire. Barrister and solicitor. Barrister and solicitor.
Okay, all right.
At least as long as I'm in Canada. That's a very Canadian-British thing.
Okay. All right. So
the barrister fancy and solicitor. Thing to call yourself is barrister and solicitor. Now you move down to the States, you might say attorney at law, you know, for example.
Okay. All right. But the barrister and solicitor does not come before your name. It's not like a, yeah. You know,
no, it's, you just, know what? It's just Mr. James S.M. Kitchen, barrister and solicitor.
You know? Do you know what you would do? Like, you know, if you're a reverend, you put Rev and then your name. If you're a doctor, you do DR. Do you know what barrister and solicitor go right before a lawyer's names?
Here we come with the lawyer jokes.
Okay, there you go. All right. So James, we've actually got some incredible news. I'm just having a lot of fun trying to get our listeners to understand the context of this show, but we've got some incredible news and I want you to tell people about it because really the goal of this show, everybody, is to take what James is saying and then for you to go to the website and read and be able to cut and paste and be able to use at all of your resources for the next 20 years of your life to be able to have a primary document that is so powerful and so helpful within any climate, but in our Canadian climate specifically right now. So James, what are we talking about today?
Talking about court transcripts, which can be really exciting. I've read a few of them myself in cases I've not been involved in, and they're really exciting. They sometimes get quoted in cases and, you know, some real big bombshells come out. But a lot of people, I think, find them boring. You know, they can go on for hundreds of pages, and in some cases it can get really monotonous and time-consuming to read them. But they matter here more than usual because these are transcripts of expert witnesses. And so just briefly to explain this, an expert witness is somebody who can actually give their opinion, because normally in a court and any type of judicial proceeding before a tribunal or a hearing body or whatever, you cannot give your opinion on anything. I can't give you my opinion that your coffee mug, you know, is cool. I can't say that. It's completely inadmissible evidence. Okay. The only exception to that, is when you have experts, okay? And now they have to go through a process to be qualified as an expert, right? So you can get somebody who's an expert in asphalt, right? And that asphalt expert can talk about how many feet it would take for a certain type of tire with a certain amount of tread to stop on a certain type of asphalt, right? That's an opinion. Well, you know, Joe Blow, he might know quite a bit about asphalt, but he can't give that opinion. Okay. Only somebody who's been qualified as an asphalt expert could give that. So here we have hundreds and hundreds of pages of five experts who have been qualified as experts to give their opinion on whether or not masks are effective and whether or not they're harmful. And that's a pretty big deal in our country. And has been now for a year and a half, because millions of people have been muzzled in this country, supposedly to somehow reduce the spread of COVID-19 and then indirectly somehow, you know, save lives or save the healthcare system or whatever, right? That's the general theory. And, you know, generally it comes along with this admonition that it's no big deal, just put it on, you know, it's like wearing a seatbelt, you know, and then there's been probably several hundred thousand people in the country, maybe even millions of people who have said, wait a minute, I know I'm not a doctor, I know I'm not a scientist, but this just doesn't make any sense. These darn things don't work. They are harmful. And this is totally destructive to our society. And why are we doing this? And so, you know, and then there's other people like me that would also say, not only are the masks themselves a big issue, but it's part of the conditioning to set you up for a society where the government can take partial ownership of your body by saying, inject this thing in it. And if you don't, you're now a second-class citizen, right? The conspiracy theorists like me tried to warn everybody in 2020, if you accept the masks, no big deal. Then in 2021, what you'll be doing is asked to accept an experimental dangerous injection into your body, right? No big deal to put a mask on, maybe, maybe not. Pretty darn big deal to have something that you don't want, that is dangerous, that is experimental, injected into your body. Right. And if you don't, you can't work and you can't do things. So, you know, that's an overview of why this is, why I think this is important. Go ahead.
So, James, just before we go on, I want you to pause and explain which case we're talking about. And also, you've shared with me that these transcripts were to be suppressed, and that the chiropractic college or the regulatory body that was that is prosecuting in this case was trying to silence these transcripts. So talk about the importance of, you know, what the case is, and then the importance of the fact that people will be able to go to our website and just click and search words out of a PDF file and get lots of information quickly, why that's so important.
Mm-hmm. So yes, this involves the case of Dr. Walls being prosecuted by the chiropractic college in Alberta for not wearing a mask, even though he has a medical condition that should exempt him from wearing it. So, you know, because of that prosecution, Dr. Wall put up a defense. As part of that defense, it was calling for experts and other lay witnesses to get the evidence in that he could rely on to make legal argument to say, I didn't do anything wrong. There wasn't professional misconduct on my part. Actually, there was constitutional and human rights violations on the part of the college and even doing this and having this mandate against me. This, you know, briefly, that's what the case is about. So, of course, these transcripts are the record of the questioning of these experts, like I said, right? So I question them, and then the lawyer for the other side will cross-examine, right? That's what these transcripts are. They are the live, unpredicted, unscripted testimony of these experts. And so we did this. We had 4 or 5, 6 days of hearing of only the experts. There's an enormous amount of it going on, right? Then we got to the end of it, and I said to opposing counsel, the lawyer on the other side, said, look, so now that we're done the evidence phase of this hearing, we have the argument still in April. I said, look, we're going to publish these transcripts because the world needs to know. You know, this is really important. It's really valuable information. You know, we're going to do that, as is our right to do that, because we have something in Canada called the open court principle, which means that all court proceedings are by default open to the public, accessible. You can hear them, you can listen to them, you can read the transcripts, you can go to them, etc. Okay, that's by default. There's very rare exceptions. There's also the right to a fair and public hearing. That's section 11 of the charter. That's a right that every person has when a government body persecutes them. Okay. The open court principle is reflected in freedom of expression, right, which actually includes the right to listen, the right to hear, not just the right to express. Okay, so Dr. Wall has a right to express by giving out these transcripts. Everybody listening to this today has a right to read them as part of freedom of expression, because you have a right to listen, okay? That's the open court principle, and then there's a right to a fair and public hearing. So I said, you know, we're gonna exercise our rights to release this stuff. The college said, no, we don't want you to. I said, why? And they said, well, we're worried about, you know, privacy and security and safety and all that stuff. I said, no, no problem. We'll redact the names. No problem. We'll redact the names of the tribunal members. And, you know, Mr. Opposing Lawyer, I'll redact your name and I'll redact the name of the people at the college, the state. No problem. They don't need their names to talk about the science of masks, right? He said, oh, okay. Well, we still don't want them going out. I said, why? He said, well, we think it's too soon. Okay, well, I mean, you got to bring an application, because that's called a publication ban, right? Which is a fancy word for secrecy, yeah. Right? If these transcripts are sealed, it's secret. Now we have a secret hearing, right? As if we're in Soviet Russia, as if we're in Maoist China. We don't have a public hearing. We now have a secret hearing. That's a pretty darn big deal. Like, this open court principle is like a fundamental cornerstone of our supposedly free and democratic society, because everybody knows, not that hard to figure out, when you have a private hearing, you have corruption. You don't have truth and justice, right? When you have an open public hearing, you have truth and justice, or at least a lot more of it. That's why it's a fundamental right for individuals to have an open and public and fair hearing. So I said, well, yes, this is ridiculous, right? So they brought their application and they made their argument. And I said, look, you know, I made my argument in the Supreme Court of Canada cases that set out over and over and over and over again, this stuff has to be released. That's how we keep our society less corrupt and open. And this is before the tribunal, by the way, that's going to decide in the end whether Dr. Wall committed professional discipline. So the other side made their argument, you know, about how somehow it's too early to do this. And ultimately they lost. Fortunately, the tribunal did follow the law. They did listen to me. And they ordered the release of these transcripts. We shouldn't have had to go through that. It was unfortunate, actually, that we had to go through that process, because it's ridiculous that the college was trying to basically make these transcripts secret. And, you know, people obviously are going to ask me, well, why were they doing this? Well, ultimately, the answer is obvious. It's embarrassing, right? It exposes, right? It exposes how poor their expert was. It exposes how wrong their policy was. It exposes how unscientific all of these masking measures and lockdown measures are. And, you know, nobody on the official elite side of things, like the colleges, they don't want that, right? Challenges their control, their power, their narrative, right? And embarrasses them, makes them look like idiots, which they have acted like most of the time. The last few months, they have acted like idiots when it comes to this stuff, because of the evidence is staring them in the face. So, I mean, that's ultimately the reason why. The college didn't say that. They're not going to say that. Of course, they can't admit that on the record. But I mean, I don't know why else would they'd be motivated to try and keep this stuff secret. You know, when there is no reason to, and there's just a by default a right to release it. So, you know, it's important that we have this, because I would say the best collection of scientific expert opinion evidence against masking that has gone through any type of judicial or quasi-judicial hearing in this country so far in the last couple of years. We've had a few cases on lockdowns generally, but they've all been very broad and global and focusing on all the measures. And so, of course, they haven't been able to go in depth with masking. This one is very in depth on masking itself, because that's the issue in this case. So, and, you know, I guess people would again question, why is that such a big deal? And as I would go back to before and say, masking is a really foundational thing for a lot of the tyranny that has happened and is continuing to happen. And so if we can take out, you know, that foundation, then some of the other tyranny, I would say, you know, especially the vaccine tyranny, would begin to crumble. So that's why I think this is so important, because this is evidence against that issue. You know, in a larger amount and in a more comprehensive amount than anywhere else you're going to find it, I think. And it really leaves no doubt. You know, there really is no debate. You know, I mean, I like having debate. Let's debate whether or not masks work. But I think when you read through this evidence, you just come to the conclusion at the end of it that, you know what, everything we thought about common sense and oxygen and the you know, how the size of the virus and how cloth masks, I mean, everything we thought about, it's all true. It's all accurate. Everything the government's saying on this is false. That's what this shows. And that's a big deal.
Okay. So why don't you get us into some of the highlights of the evidence? You know, you would obviously bring forward a witness, and then, I assume that there would be an examination, and then there would be a cross examination. I'm kind of interested in kind of walking through each witness, but for the sake of time, I think we probably need you to highlight for us. So, what are some of the biggest pieces of information you want us to know? And can you explain again, maybe just the cross examination or the examination process really quick, so people who aren't regularly going to court understand it?
Yeah. So if I have an expert witness, I bring them up and I say, look, I ask a bunch of questions about their qualifications. And I say, I want this expert tendered. I want this witness tendered as an expert in this. The other side will say, no, this person, you know, shouldn't be qualified as this. They don't have what it takes. And then the tribunal makes a ruling. Okay. They're qualified as an expert. You go ahead, Mr. Kitchen, and question them. So I did that for all four of these, Dr. Wall's experts. They were all qualified, all accepted. And then I go through and I do what's called my examination in chief, right? So I give the questions to them that I, that hopefully will produce the evidence I want to get into the record, right? You can't predict the people are going to answer, which is part of the fun. But I ask those questions, they give answers, right? And then I go all the way through. When I think I've gotten all the evidence I want, I'm done. I pass it over to opposing counsel and he goes through and he cross-examines them, right? Which is to basically, he asks them questions to try to trip them up or make them contradict themselves or get the evidence that he wants that helps his case, and then we're done. In this case, my examinations were much longer. The cross-examinations were very, very short on the other side. I think that's for two reasons. One, the argument of the college is they're trying to make this about the fact that Dr. Wall disobeyed. It doesn't matter that what he disobeyed is potentially not scientific or not good. The fact is, if you disobey whatever the college says, you're unprofessional, and that's the end of the game. The other thing, too, of course, is my experts were very good. The evidence is very damning for them, and so, you know, any good lawyer does not do an extensive cross-examination if he doesn't think he's going to get much. And because it's very risky. Cross-examination is very risky. Most risky thing that any lawyer ever does. If you can't get good stuff, then you just don't even do it, or you do very little of it. So there was very little of it in this case, except for me, of course, because the college called an expert. That took a whole day. There was a whole morning that opposing counsel spent questioning him, and then I spent a whole afternoon cross-examining him because I had lots to cross-examine, and I deemed that risk worth it, and it turned out to be well worth it. So just briefly, I'll go through some of the things that our experts had to say, Dr. Wall's experts had to say. We had three medical experts and one occupational health and safety expert. I'll go through him first. His name is Chris Schaefer. He's a guy here in Alberta that's been doing occupational health and safety for 20 or 30 years. Big expert in it. He actually does as a living prior to COVID. He did a lot of fit testing and training on masks. So one thing he pointed out, he said, look, these things aren't masks. I'm sorry, but masks actually, in order to be called that, have to have engineered breathing openings. Okay. So you think of like a gas mask that you would use like in mustard gas, right? It's got these two great big filters on them, right? Our culture is very aware of this type of mask because we've done all kinds of stuff with it over the last 100 years. He says, look, that's a mask. Engineered breathing openings. The purpose of that, he says, is your airflow has to be uninhibited or unobstructed as much as possible, right? A good mask barely inhibits your breathing because what happens is there's a valve for your exhalation to come out, and then there's a valve or two for inhalation to come in, right? So inside the mask, there's no buildup, right? It's fresh air coming in, exhaled air coming out, and the filters filter the contaminant. Maybe it's mustard gas, whatever it is, right? So look, technically a goalie mask or a Halloween mask, those are masks because they have engineered breathing openings. They won't filter anything, but they have engineered breathing openings. That's why those masks all have holes around the mouth. He's like, what these things are that we're using for COVID, he calls them breathing barriers, because all they are is a thing that goes over your face and it acts as a barrier between you and the outside air. He's like, that's not a mask. It's a barrier. Okay. It's just simply blocking your breathing. He's like, so that's bad. And the reason for that, I mean, we all know this, it's common sense. Look, if you have something covering your breathing, covering your mouth, you are restricting airflow. So what's happening is you're restricting the amount of available oxygen, first of all, and that's very important because you have to be able to get a certain amount of oxygen or your body can't function properly. The level for that is 19.5%. Now, sorry to get really nerdy here, but oxygen in the world is somewhere around 21%. That's healthy, right? You and I are breathing that right now. So you can't go much below that. If you do, it's like immediately dangerous to health and safety. That's how the occupational health and safety people call it. Immediately dangerous to health and safety. If you go below 19.5% oxygen in the air that you're breathing, you are immediately dangerous to health and safety. In other words, if a workplace, this Chris Schaefer would know that, if you have a workplace where you're working in a factory or shop and your oxygen level drops below 19.5, it must be shut down immediately. It is immediately dangerous to life and health, okay? Well, inside these masks, your oxygen level is below that on a consistent basis. It's consistently like low 19s, just between 19 and 19.5 consistently. So, and that's immediately dangerous to health and safety. And, you know, that it stays that way for the hours that you're wearing this thing. Okay. And that's what causes all the headaches and terrible, but not necessarily, you know, immediately going to kill you type of things that people are experiencing all the time when they wear these things. That's one reason. And that's one problem. Okay. The other thing is carbon dioxide, right? You breathe out. Well, because this is a barrier and not there's no exhalation valve in these masks, your carbon dioxide gets stuck in there and you end up rebreathing it. Okay. And anything above 1,000 parts per million carbon dioxide, that means how much carbon dioxide is in the air you're actually breathing, is toxic. It is unsafe. It's dangerous. It's hazardous. Hazardous is the word that occupational health and safety people use. Well, inside of these masks, the parts per million is often 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 parts per million. Okay, so this is what you're breathing in when you wear this thing. You're breathing in toxic, highly toxic levels of carbon dioxide, right? By the way, is also an asphyxiant, which means that it further kicks out the good oxygen you need. Okay, so this thing is filling up with carbon dioxide. There's not much oxygen in it. And you're struggling to breathe in the oxygen. You're not getting enough. And what you're getting is a whole bunch of carbon dioxide you're not supposed to be getting, which, you know, causes all the fatigue and the headaches and brain fog and all the other things that everybody's experiencing. It's common sense, right? But this guy can talk about it on a technical level because he deals with it on a daily basis, right? And then, of course, he also talked about the fact, look, these things are not fit tested. They don't make a seal on the face. And so ultimately, they do act as a barrier. But because they're acting as a barrier, what happens is that most of the air comes in and out through the holes, right? Through the holes in your nose and your cheeks, yeah. Maybe on your chin, right? Well, that's obviously relevant to this whole thing, because unless this thing is sealed, then you just have COVID aerosols, if the person's actually, you know, giving off any of those, coming in and out all the time. So it's pretty common sense why these things don't work.
So I have to tell you that my first reaction to this, James, is just utter annoyance, because I am so tired of needing an expert to say the things. Like, an expert used to be somebody who would say common sense things with lots of experience around them. Like, you know, when you get trained to manage propane and gases, but usually when you go through safety training, everybody gets to the end of the day and says, yes, that's just all common sense. I'm going to go up on a roof. Hey, by the way, if you tether off on a roof, it's safer than not tethering off. Great. I knew that. My mom told me that when I was getting, but so everything that you just said that expert witness just shared, I'm sure that Mr. Schaefer did it with incredible competence. I'm looking at his resume. Like, he knows what he's talking about, but everything you just said, you and I have been talking about for 2 years. Like, all you have to do is put on a mask and breathe back in your coffee breath for 4 minutes. And you go, oh, I recognize that I am somehow not diffusing all of the air leaving my mouth and not taking in clean, fresh air. Yet people still walk around and do this, and it drives me nuts. So that's the one response. The other question I had for you is, how did the other attorney respond to this line of evidence? You know, what was his argument or what was his cross-examination to Mr. Schaefer? You said it was short. I'm not sure, he might have done the same thing for all of the witnesses, but are you aware of kind of what his strategy was to deal with all of this very basic and important and common sense and authoritative information?
Well, there wasn't much to it. I want to talk, I think it's interesting, and he did this with all of my experts, is he asked them, so Chris Schaefer was actually a member of the paramedic college in Alberta for 1 year. And all my other experts are all members. Actually, no, Dr. Vidal's not. But two of my other members are witnesses, are members of colleges. So he said to Chris Schaefer, look, you know, you disagree with all this, but you'd wear a mask if your college told you to, wouldn't you? And of course, you know, one of the fun things about being a lawyer is when a witness gives the opposite answer of what the other lawyer wants. Okay, so the lawyer asked this to get him to admit that he would wear a mask to keep his license. Okay, because so Dr. Wallace should have just worn a mask. It doesn't matter if they don't work. Call told him to. He should have just worn a mask. Christopher Schaefer said, no, I wouldn't. Give him my license before I'd wear a mask. My health is mine and it belongs to me and not the college, and I would protect my health before wearing a mask to keep my license. Yeah, that's going to go down as one of my top 10 favorite moments as a lawyer, I think, at least for the next few years until I have better experiences. That was very fun to watch.
So what you're telling me is that the attorney's strategy was, but you just do what you're told to keep your job, right? Like the Communist Party wants you to just do what you're told, so you would do that, right? Like that's not even a. This is what I'm getting at. You know, it's not even a question of any legitimate focus. It's just, you would have done what you were told, right? That's great. I love it when that happens, when someone just tells the truth and doubles down. That's amazing.
Well, you know, and admittedly, like two of my other experts are medical doctors or physicians. So they're regulated by the College of Physicians and Surgeons. And they did say, yes, we currently wear a mask, even though we disagree with it. And we do it because our college tells us to, or our employer tells us to, when we have to. They admitted that, right? Now, again, you know, yeah, you raised the point. How is that actually relevant? But it was just really fun to watch that in this case, at least I have one guy who would say, yeah, I'd give up my license before I, which obviously these things are pretty harmful. You know, he knows, because he knows better than most, just how harmful they are to his health. And they are so harmful that he would give up his license as a regulated professional before he would wear one.
Okay. Who is our next witness? Let's walk through him.
So he's a respirologist, which means he's an expert in breathing and lungs. He's an expert in the act of respiration. Okay. Like he has a breathing lab where he tests people's breathing and stuff like that. And he commented on how masks are obviously they cause some harm. He's seen it in his lab. Okay. He's a respirologist here in Alberta.
What's his name, James?
His name is Dr. Bao Dang.
Okay.
He's quite the character. He's been bravely speaking out about this from the very beginning, and he actually lost access to the hospital where he worked in the city he was in, and had to go back to just doing his private practice because he wasn't gonna take the shot. So anyways, I'm gonna read you a couple things from the transcript just to give you a flavor of how this goes. So this is me asking a question, and I say. But then the college's expert goes on to say in the last page of his report that the efficacy of masking on disease transmission is beyond doubt. Dr. Dang, do you agree with that statement? And he answers, I do not. And then I say, let me ask you a different question. You think that statement is even reasonable? Well, personally, I don't think it's reasonable. As I mentioned before, science is open to debate, and so I think this is still a very debatable point. Right. This gives you a flavor. Like one of the things that I do is I will put, you know, look, the other side expert said this. What do you think of that? Right. And the college's expert, you know, not only did he say things that were unscientific and inaccurate, but he often was very over the top, almost kind of juvenile in the way that he would explain things. He would talk in very absolute terms, no qualifiers. He talked in a very, you know, sort of unscientific way, actually. My experts, I constantly brought them back to, you know, do you think even what he said was even defensible, reasonable? And they would say, you know, my guys were pretty polite. They'd say, well, no, not really, right? Here's another one. So the college's expert stated in his testimony that a very, very, very large number of healthcare workers in Italy contracted and died from COVID early on. He concluded that part of the reason that happened was because the Italian healthcare workers ran out of masks. Now, in your opinion, Dr. Dang, is there a causal link between masking and what happened to the Italian healthcare workers, or is that only correlation? And Dr. Dang answered, well, that would be at best correlation. Yeah. So then later on in the transcript, I say, you know, is conflating causation and correlation, is that a pretty big mistake? And Dr. Dang answers, I believe so. Right. He said the two do not always end up agreeing. Correlation may be helpful to stimulate further research and hypothesis, but the causation may turn out to be something completely different. Right. So, you know, he's just pointing out like that's a pretty immature mistake, right, to attribute causation when it should only be correlation. And again, I know I'm getting a bit nerdy here, but this is really important in the scientific world. Right. Like when something happens, you can't just jump to saying this caused this. What you do is say, well, maybe there's a correlation there. I got to do some thinking, some tests, some debates. Right. Some investigation. And that goes to the core of what's going on here. Right. There's no debate. There's no humility. There's no questions. There's no investigation or thinking. It's just, this must work because we say so. And we have the power to. And it's really degrading the level of conversation about this, right? So that's why this is important to get into this, is for my guys to remind everybody, look, we have a problem here that these so-called experts, they're not even humble enough, they're not even intelligent enough to tell the difference between correlation and causation, right? It's pretty ridiculous to say that, well, all those health workers in Italy, they must have died because they didn't have masks on. It's common sense, you know, can tell you. Now, wait a minute. I don't know that actually causes that, right?
It's interesting. I'm looking at some of the transcripts too, that, you know, I love doing the primary reading myself. And one of the other things that Dr. Dang said was, ridiculous it would have been to mandate the entire public wear masks during the past outbreaks of respiratory infections, such as H1N1 and SARS. Both are viral based, and SARS in 2003, COVID-19, they're both made of similar family type, shall we say, of a virus. SARS just means severe acute respiratory syndrome. And then he goes, in terms of our approach to public health at that time, it was radically different. There was no thought of having universal mandatory masking. The most, even in the hospital setting, we didn't have continuous masking. We had masking for patients at risk in isolated rooms, which we always would have, but I would just say in a higher volume. So he's talking about a pretty significant change that's gone on there.
And he was there. Like he's not just talking about this from an academic literature perspective. He was there personally. He saw it, experienced it. And he commented on the fact that, you know, how is it possible to do this now? And he commented on the fact that, you know, the fear level is different, the paranoia, the social media, the instant communications all across the world. You know, he and I agree with him. I mean, he believes that those are part of the reasons that we were able to do this absurd thing now, but not back then, right? And I think that also speaks to the loss of common sense. Right. A lot of people have noticed and commented in the last 10, 15 years that the decrease in common sense in our society. And of course, you have to have that if you're going to have a government come in and impose all these, you know, quite plainly idiotic things and have the majority of people just accept them and go along. You have to have a lack of common sense in order for that to happen. Right. And, you know, I think that's part of the reason why and that's why you couldn't have done this 15 years ago. It's why I don't even know if there was an attempt to do it. With SARS-CoV-1 or whatever it is, maybe that's because the people who are pulling all the strings didn't think they could get away with it. I don't know, but I think that raises an important point: is that, you know, we only get to a situation like this where we're doing everything that we know hasn't worked for thousands of years of history. You know, we threw out all of our pandemic plans, as Dr. Bridle and Redman have talked about, because we've lost the common sense that is required to actually continue to do things that are semi-intelligent.
So. Did Dr. Dang get into the size of COVID-19, of the COVID-19 molecule?
He did. Him and Dr. Bridle both talked a lot about, from a physical or structural point of view, it's not surprising that the literature shows that these masks don't work, because we have to look at how small the virus is and the particles that carry the virus. And again, you know, not to get too nerdy, but, you know, ultimately the you know, if we think a million times smaller than we are, think on the level of atoms and stuff like that, the holes in these masks are like this, okay? The smallest of the holes.
Yeah.
Well, the size of the COVID particles are like this, right? So, you know, I mean, the famous sentiment is, you know, using a mask to stop COVID is like using a chain link fence to stop a handful of Skittles.
Yeah.
Not going to happen, right?
So just so everybody is fully aware, just for full disclosure, that was not a model to scale. It was not a scientific reference. It would have been something, Mr. James Kitchen just might've done something like what the Alberta College witness might've given, just a general.
Yeah.
Sorry. I just had to dog on you. Like, it's totally true. It's like this and like this, and it's been obvious since day one. Okay, keep going. I'm slowing you down by, this is really key information that everybody is going to be able to copy and paste, put on their Twitter account. They're going to be able to reference at dinner parties when people are calling them foolish. And again, this is testimony in court that has been cross-examined and found credible. It's been found resilient, and the cross-examinations have been lacking because, of course, there's nothing to get. This is all good science and good information. Okay, keep going. Where else do you want to go?
So let's talk. I'll leave Dr. Bridle for the last. So let's move on to the next one I had. And I can't disclose this gentleman's name. He's an infectious disease expert and a medical microbiologist. So again, you know, somebody who has the chops to know what he's talking about with this type of stuff, right? And I got some stuff I want to read you from his. I spent more time with his this morning. Now, you know, in the real version of the transcript, this is page 234. I'm not quite sure what it is in the one online, but you can search it. When it comes to COVID, okay, the timing is going to be predicted by season, and you can't change that, as godlike as these people seem to think they are. The number of infections is going to be predicted by population density, and the mortality is going to be predicted by the age structure. Again, I know that's a little technical, but what's that saying in common sense is, you're going to get cyclical waves of this based on seasonal. You know, you're gonna get the worst peak is gonna be, you know, in the middle of winter, and then you're gonna get other waves. And you can't stop that. That's just gonna happen because of the cyclical seasonal nature of this, right? And as all my experts said, that's really obvious. We looked at all these waves. We didn't even blunt them with our restrictions. They happened whether we did anything or not. That's the way this stuff works. You might not like it, right? I mean, you might not like people getting sick and dying, but welcome to planet Earth. That's kind of how it works, right? And then you said, look, the number of infections, well, so the number of people that actually get it, whether they have symptoms or not, is a function of how many people are in an area, right? You have 8 million people in New York City, you're going to get a whole lot more cases really fast all of a sudden. It's just, you can't. So what he calls that in technical terms is a non-modifiable factor, which is to say, you can't change that there's 8 million people living in New York. You can put in all the restrictions you want, but you can't change that. And that actually is what matters. And then he's saying, you know, mortality. So people dying are the really old people, and you can't change that. Unless you go ahead and remove the old people through euthanasia, you can't change the fact that how much death you're going to have is determinant of how many frail elderly people you have. Okay, so again, this is common sense, right? What we've seen and what we know from the data, even if we're not a scientist, we can know from talking to our friends and family, and we can know from reading even a cursory review of this, that if you're quite old, 70 plus, especially 80 plus, if you have other comorbidities, you know, you're overweight, you got heart disease, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
You are at an actual risk of potentially actually dying from this. Whereas if you're under 70 and you don't have a comorbidity, you're as likely to die from this as you are from getting struck by lightning. Like we just know that, right? And you can't change that because that is the virus, and because you're not God, you can't change that, right? And so he gave some very obvious examples. So, you know, in South Africa, the population's a lot younger, population's a lot older, in America, Canada, Britain. So what do you get? You get a higher ratio of people that get COVID-19 and die than you do in Africa because of that, right? I mean, the ratio is always really low. Like one of the things that this doctor said is, look, the ratio, which is to say the amount of people that get it and then die, is the same as influenza now, right? This is like any other cold or flu. You know, those fluctuate and change from year to year, but that's what it is, right? And one of the things I asked him, I said, because we talked about the fact that everybody thought this was going to be crazy severe in the beginning. He said it was. He's like, for the first couple months, you know, there was an infection fatality ratio that was above influenza. And so I asked him, well, when did it change? And he's like, April of 2020, all the scientists who were paying attention knew that you couldn't stop this thing, and that it had an infection fatality ratio the same as influenza. I asked Dr. Bridle the same thing. And by the way, he had not listened to this other guy's testimony the day before. He said the same thing. He said, look, any scientist who was paying attention, who was being honest, could tell you that we knew we couldn't stop this thing. We knew it was going to be endemic, which is a fancy word for saying it's here. It's never going to go away. We're going to have to live with it. We knew that, like, literally in the late winter, spring of 2020, we knew that. So like just as restrictions were going in, right, we already knew that they weren't going to work. We didn't need them. It was just the way it is. Like, we knew that. And then of course the restrictions came in and we stuck with them.
And then what was the cross-examination to this, James? Like, because, you know, mask is one thing to be able to go, okay, microns, look at airflow, all that type of stuff. Now you're getting into some pretty big, I hate to use the word modeling. It's a trigger word in my life. But you're looking at maybe more macro data. So first of all, that's pretty obvious. You could say seasonally, this has come and gone the way every other virus, and we've seen it, and there's no blip. You could do the population density quite easily. You could do the age of infection, but what was the response? Like he had to have something to respond and say, no, the lockdowns worked.
Well, of course, the college did put in their own expert, and that expert said over and over again, the lockdowns work. Right. He gave one example to say that there was a big to-do here in Alberta in November, December of 2020. Okay. Prior to that, the lockdowns had not been as bad as they were in the rest of the country. You know, redneck, libertarian Albertans. For whatever reason, Kenny decided to go full tyrant and, full on lockdown. Like, you can't even go over to people's houses for Christmas. So the college's expert, he went so far as to say, well, you know, look, the wave came in, and then a few weeks later, we brought in our lockdown, and then the wave kept going up, and then it went down later. Well, we know that the lockdown didn't cause the wave to keep going up. We know that it did cause it to go down a few weeks later, which is really, it's fanciful thinking. It's really results-oriented thinking, right? It really goes to show that he became so obsessed with the correctness of his position that he said a rather absurd thing. And this goes back to the correlation causation thing, because I asked my experts, the data explanation of what happened in the fall of 2020 make any sense? And they're like, no. There's definitely no causation. There may not even be any correlation there between the lockdown and the timing of the wave. My guys all said the wave happened because that's how it was going to go. And none of these restrictions work. A lot of my guys said, little to negligible effect. Everything has happened the last 2 years the way it was going to happen. Nothing we've done has actually changed anything. It would have happened almost exactly the same way had we done nothing. So had we stopped trying to play God, had we been the humans we are, the same thing would have happened as has happened. Having said that, the only caveat to that is the lockdowns have actually killed a lot of people. So that's the only difference.
And the lockdowns have helped move towards economic collapse, and the lockdowns have had helped, the wealth gap between Walmart that's been allowed to be open and the small business that's been forced to be shut. The lockdowns have been quite effective in many things, but nothing to do with the waves of COVID. Okay, that's good.
Okay. So on this point, that this doctor said that was fascinating, he talked about something called the difficulty with medical reversal. He said this, I'm on page 297 of the real transcript. And again, you can search for this. He said, in answer to a question I asked, it's difficult once there's an established practice. And we know this from thousands of years of history in medicine. It's very difficult once there's an assumed standard of practice to change that practice. Affecting that change is very challenging, he says. Once a practice is assumed to be beneficial, even early on, when there's clear evidence to the contrary, it's very difficult for medical practitioners. It's a psychological thing, just part of humans and who we are as well, to change that practice. Now, he went on at length, but what this is getting to is, because I asked him, if the data was there, why did we do this? And he said, that's why. Because even though the data was there to show that everything we were going to do and everything we had started to do was not going to work, we all believed it was going to work. We hoped it was going to work. We wanted it to work. Therefore, we did it anyways. And then I asked them, why did we keep going with it? Because of course we did the lockdowns in the spring of 2020. They didn't work.
Yeah.
But then we all brought them back in really heavy around the Christmas of 2020, right? And that's when they really solidified in the minds of people that this is what we do. A bad cold comes in and we lock everybody down, and then we virtue signal about how we're saving granny. Right. That's what we do. And so, even though the evidence says otherwise, and he says, well, look. He gave an example. He's like, look, I got guys who are 30. He's like, I've been a doctor for 11 years. I got guys that have been a doctor for 30 years. They're still treating pneumonia with 14 days of antibiotics. I'm still trying to get it through their heads that it's supposed to be only 5 days, and they won't listen to me, and they won't do it even though the evidence is obvious, because that's their practice and that's the way they do things, and they'll do it until they're done. It's the same thing here. Lockdowns are now how we defeat COVID. It doesn't matter that it doesn't work. It doesn't matter that the evidence says otherwise. This is what we do. And he's like, this is the problem. This is why experts like me can say with all the evidence, we shouldn't do this. We shouldn't have masks. We shouldn't have masks in school. We shouldn't have masks on professionals. But why do we keep doing it? Because that's just what we've done. It's tradition. That's basically what it is. Tradition. Now, it's not science. It's not medicine. It's tradition.
And you and I are going to talk about this for years to come, but it is a tradition that comes with penalty, and it is tradition that is enforced by a stick, and it is tradition that is enforced by people who are highly motivated to keep people compliant, because that is the authoritarian vision that they have for their own regulatory body, right? Like, you and I've talked about this before, just a really quick overview for everybody. Regulatory bodies are supposed to stop people from malpractice. If someone's under drugs, you're not supposed to cut their leg off because you're had a bad day and you got mad at this client and they had bad breath and you want to abuse them. Or of course, more of a real life example is a sexual predator or something like this. But what the regulatory bodies have morphed into, as does so many of our government bureaucracies, is they have to create reasons for their own existence and reasons for their own growth. And therefore, they have this very idealized vision for how everybody does everything. Yep. And now they are motivated by self-interest to make sure that cases like this are silenced and that individuals who would question them are sidelined so that their voice is discredited. And so, talking about a voice that people have attempted to discredit, if you're ready to move on to Dr. Bridle, I'd be happy to do that. Or if you will have some last parts of that last physician, that's fine too.
I have two. I'm quoting from this doctor. And he said, it's political, right? Like, it just comes down to politics, a philosophy of how things are done, whether you're interventionist or not. And people are interventionists in the economy. People are interventionists in the climate. People are interventionists in medicine. And to some degree, that's a political question as well. Right. All of my witnesses, sometimes with questions from me, sometimes unsolicited, they commented on the fact that this is political. It's just the way it is. Can't avoid it. Right. And, that's a lot of what everybody on our side has been trying to say. This, you wake up. This isn't about science or medicine or health or safety or evidence. It's about politics. Let's stop being babies. Let's start being adults who live in a civil society and recognize that, all these decisions are political, right? When the CDC removes its mask mandate, it's political. Anyways, the last thing I want to say is kind of this is a more of a technical bombshell, I think. I think this really, in a way that people can digest, although it's technical, just the level of ineffectiveness of masks. Okay, so this infectious disease expert says this: in a general healthy population, we need to have 1,100 people wear a mask for 8 weeks to prevent one infection, not one death, not one hospitalization, but one infection. So 1,100 people wearing a mask for 8 weeks to prevent one infection. That's a remarkably high number. He goes on to say, and maybe it is worth masking 1,100 people for 8 weeks to prevent one death, but it's not. It's masking 1,100 people for 8 weeks to prevent one infection. He says that is the best evidence we have in support of masks or about masking in the context of SARS-CoV-2. He's citing a Bangladesh study that involved 300,000 people. It's a randomized control trial, which is the best scientific evidence available through trials and studies and reports. He's like, that's the conclusion from this study, that 1,100 asymptomatic people have to wear masks for 8 weeks to prevent one infection. And by the way, the infection fertility ratio is so low that you have to have 1,000 infections before you statistically are going to get one death. So everything I just said, times that by 1,000 before you prevent a death. Okay. And by the way, that death is statistically going to be someone who is old and frail and has comorbidities and statistically is going to die within the next 6 to 12 months. Anyways, that's not to devalue life. Obviously, I'm pro-life. Every life has dignity. Every life is loved by God. Every life is of equal worth. But the medical reality is that we are not talking about people in their 40s with kids that are just randomly dying. It's not what we're talking about with COVID. By the way, that's what happened with the Spanish flu. People randomly in their 20s and 30s and 40s that were healthy, had kids, had lives, they just dropped dead from the flu. COVID is like people that are in nursing homes that are sadly, tragically, because that's the, we live in a fallen world, are going to die statistically in the next few months, and then they die of COVID. One of the things that this doctor also mentioned was that, look, he said the best doctor in Canada that we've ever had has always said that what kills old people that are already almost going to die in this country is a respiratory infection. They're weakened by cancer, they're weakened by heart disease, they're weakened by, you know, obesity, whatever. But what actually kills them? A respiratory infection. That's what, you know, finally they're, you know, on their last legs, they get a respiratory infection, and 5 days later they're dead. That's what kills almost every old person who dies of old age in this country. And, you know, these are commonsensical things. I mean, my grandfather died of that, right? He had emphysema, and then he got something, boom, he was 90 years old and it was his time to go, right? What did he die of? I mean, he died of old age, really. You know, old and frail, respiratory infection came along and tipped him over. And it was tragic, you know? I was upset. It was his time. And these types of common sense things we've forgotten, right? You know? Anyways, I think that that quote about just how many asymptomatic people have to wear a mask for so long to prevent even one infection, then you have to do that 1,000 times over to prevent one death.
As you have rightly honed in on the age of the individual being one of the factors, which of course that was a part of the expert witness testimony. In logic, we would call that a straw man. And what I mean more literally right now is it would be a frail man. So the propaganda sets up the straw man as the norm rather than the exception. And what they've done is they've taken frail people and literally used a straw man tactic to silence everybody and say, well, what about them? And you can even hear it, you know, you can even hear it in, as you're saying it, James, like, you know, your grandfather's died, my grandfather's passed away. You know, my wife's father has passed away. These are tragic things. And it's such an easy little straw man to say, you're so insensitive. Why don't you think about the frail 90-year-old? Well, you know, Psalm 90 says, you turn men back to dust, saying, return to dust, O son of men. We're encouraged in the Psalms to number our days right, that we might gain a heart of wisdom. So the difference between a real example, like the Spanish flu, is you're not creating a straw man argument, which is a logical fallacy. You're creating a real argument. And, you know, there is this balance where all of us who love life and would protect life, we're pro-life advocates. We want to stand up for the preborn. We want them to have bodily autonomy. But it's also like, you're not a brute to say that a cold is an old man's friend and eases him into the next life. And that is the Lord's timing for him. It's different than killing the elderly. It's different than what is actually happening with the MAID bills that have gone through. So it's just a complete straw man. Then you add this idea. I'm trying to think of a sports analogy for it. So if you have 1,000 players on a field kicking the ball for 8 weeks to hit a shot that lands 10 feet from the net. And then you have, what was it? 110,000 players on a field shooting a ball for 8 weeks in order to get the ball 10 feet past her to get a goal. That is how efficacious it is in order to wear masks. Now, again, if you are a sports fan, anybody knows that is like, it's not even scientifically viable. It's lunacy. Like when he says that's the best medical evidence that we have, that's a kind medical way of saying we've done the research and it's absolutely ridiculous and irresponsible. And you know what though is really effective though? If you have 100,000, 110,000 people on a field with masks on, because you told them to stand on the field for 8 weeks and you're sitting back watching to see if they do what they told. And when they do it for 8 weeks straight, that is what is accomplished. when you forced masking of individuals. Okay. Dr. Yeah. Bridle.
Well, you know, I encourage you to read Dr. Bridle's because he's just such a wealth of knowledge. His is by far the longest. We went to the entire 7 or 8 hour day with him. I think it's like 300 pages long. And I admit I haven't been through it. You know, he confirmed a lot of what the other experts said that, look, we knew in the late winter, early spring of 2020 that this was going to become endemic, which means you can't stop it. It's too late. It's already going to do its thing. None of these things are going to work. Okay. We knew that then. That's just the way it is. We knew back then, of course, also that we knew that only old people were really going to be affected by this, and nobody else was at all, unless they really had a whole bunch of serious comorbidities. We knew that, right? So like we knew all of that stuff in the spring of 2020 and could have actually followed our pandemic planning plans and just, you know, did some mild interventionist stuff to protect the old people as best we could. And then stop trying to play God. That would have been the scientific thing to do. And it's not like this is actually new. Like, we actually had plans developed on how we dealt with prior pandemics. And so how to deal with this one. And we just threw those out the window. Like, we didn't follow them at all. Right. I mean, this is the big thing that Colin Redman has, he's been an expert witness in a few cases. He's gone on about that. Right?
David Redman's been absolutely. David Redman,
Yeah. So it's the same old common sense stuff, right? And so Dr. Bridle spent a lot of time helping the tribunal members understand what's called aerosolized transmission. Okay. So I'll get into this just a little bit because this was a big part of what he had to say more than other experts. Most transmission of COVID happens through aerosolized. Okay. So what I mean by aerosolized is these tiny, 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 tiny micro little water droplets. Right. Imagine when you like you're getting excited and you spit and you see it onto your desk. That's called spittle. That's a great big one, right? And you know, if you're shedding COVID virus, it'll be in there, right? It can and does spread that way, although not very effectively, right? Because it's heavy and it just drops right down, right? What the masks do actually stop is that, right? If you spit, right? Masks, these breathing barriers are basically spit guards. And they are actually effective at that, right? What Dr. Bridle says, look, most of it's through aerosols, which is these tiny little things that just float around in the air. He's like, go out, you know, when you can see your breath in the fall or the winter, right? When you can on your glasses and they condense, that's the aerosized, right? You've moisturized the air with these tiny micro droplets. Those things are full of COVID. And that's how COVID actually, most of the time, that's how it spreads. It spreads through the spittle, right? But mostly because that's not very effective. How it effectively spreads is through the aerosols. Well, going back to what Chris Schaefer said, right? The air comes out here, right? And it comes actually through the thing because, right? These little aerosols, they're this big, right? And the smallest pore sizes in the masks are this big. So they just right through, right? And then they're full of little virus particles and they land and whatever, and they float around and you breathe them in because that's the thing, right? You breathe it up through your mask and somebody else breathes it in through their mask. There you go. Now you got the virus inside of you. That's how it works. And so he went at great lengths to explain this, like just from a structural point of view. It's confirmed in the literature, right? But to actually explain why masks don't work, we see that they don't work in the literature, in the studies, right? Why they don't work, it's really pretty simple. It's structural, right? You know, chain link fences don't keep a skittle storm away, right? They just go right through it. It's the same thing with aerosolized transmission. So the other big thing I know you got a question. The other big thing I haven't touched on that Dr. Bridle talked about at length, and so did the other doctor, is what we call asymptomatic transmission. Again, common sense, right? Asymptomatic is a fancy word for healthy. If you're healthy and you don't have symptoms, you're almost never transmitting anything, right? You begin to transmit only when you begin to have symptoms. Yeah. All these masking mandates are to mask everybody, which logically means to mask the asymptomatic, right? Yeah. So not only do they not work, not only do they cause harm, but it's just irrational, asinine, and ridiculous to mask asymptomatic people because they're not transmissible in any event. There is no such thing as asymptomatic transmission. It's negligible. I'm not gonna say it's non-existent. One of my experts said it's negligible. It almost doesn't happen, right? And that's not weird. We've known that for thousands of years. And so that has to factor into the analysis because in Dr. Wall's case, right, patients and chiropractors aren't even allowed to go into the office if they're symptomatic. We call that administrative controls. Okay. So you only have an asymptomatic patient and an asymptomatic practitioner ever in the office, right? It's just the whole thing is layers of absurdity. You got a question?
Okay, so two thoughts. Number one, earlier on, you mentioned the weight of the spittle or the water droplets. I have interviewed a control specialist, and when he talked about the aerosol spread or the aerosol contamination, he also says, like, he said those are plumes of gas that are very light, and they can linger in the air for quite a time. So again, tracing and blaming and all is ridiculous, but also spread, it's just ridiculous. And then of course, we've referenced the Spanish flu, but even during the Black Plague, you know, people had to go to markets, and that's where stuff spread. And oh, guess what? Like if you go into a grocery store wearing a mask and you breathe and this nice plume of COVID-19 comes out, like, you're walking around 10 minutes later and someone just walks through that, and it's inevitable. Like, it's endemic, as you were saying. The one thing I wanted to ask you in response to what you're getting there at the very end about Dr. Bridle is, how did your expert witnesses, so this is me leading the witness, like, were you impressed by your expert witnesses? I know it's an obvious thing, but Dr. Bridle is such an impressive, kind, fairly genuine man. You know, he knows he's long-winded. I did an interview with him at last 2.5 hours. It was very informative. He nailed it.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that as one of the most long-winded individuals that I know. So, like, you know, humble, kind, very sincere. Now again, I'm leading the witness, and I'm patting, but were you generally impressed with your witnesses, how they handled themselves under duress, and did any of them lose their temper? Did any of them change their tune on you, or what are people going to see in the transcripts? Professionals answering intelligently.
Obviously, I'm a little biased.
Well, you've admitted your bias, so now you can tell people what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I was really impressed with all of them for in different ways and for different reasons. I mean, they all had, you know, a wealth of knowledge and experience. They were very level-headed, academic, professional. I mean, that's not a lot to expect. This is why it's funny to me that you asked this, because yes, my experts are exactly what you expect them to be: intelligent academics who act professionally and speak scientifically, which is kind of a low bar, really. That's what they are. So they were being themselves.
Look, but
the reason that's a big deal is because the college's expert was the opposite of that.
The only thing you have to do to grow your church now is to just keep it open. So the bar is low everywhere. Like, we've just seen James Kitchen and Mike Thiessen could have sat around and written the most brilliant futuristic satire that 4 years ago, no, everyone would laugh at it. You know, we've got Dwight from The Office walking in, I don't know how many seasons ago, in a hazmat suit in order to not get contaminated. And it was a joke. And then literally in our country, this has unfolded. So the point is, the bar is low, and you think they met the bar.
They met the bar.
Good.
But I mean, you know, the college's expert didn't, you know, he went out of his way to insult my experts as if he was a junior high student. And that was, I actually didn't expect that. I that surprised me. I expected the college to produce somebody, you know, pretty solid and credible, right? I mean, supposedly there's some serious academics and scientists who support all this lockdown nonsense. Supposedly, I mean, I haven't met any of them yet, but I mean, I would think they must exist somewhere. It was quite bizarre cross-examining this expert. I say the college's expert because I'm not going to disclose his name yet. I will when all this is done. By the way, all this stuff will come out, but for now, his name's redacted. He's a public health doctor. He was a medical officer of health in Alberta. So he worked for the government worked for AHS as one of those guys that went around and inspected and closed places and stuff like that. Right. So he's a public health guy. Right. And I specifically asked him across examination, are you a respirologist? No. Are you, you know, an infectious disease expert? No. Are you a scientist? You know, are you a virologist? Like, Dr. Bridle's a virologist and immunologist, right? So, I mean, I had the best guys. I'm like, you know, these are the three best guys that could talk about masks. And then I had the occupational health and safety guy. I mean, I had the whole gamut covered. And then, of course, but, you know, the college brought in this public health expert who is basically just a physician who does public health, which, by the way, public health is like administrative. You don't ever treat a patient. You sit at a desk and you close businesses, right? That's what you do as a public health officer, okay? And so that's what he was. I mean, he was a physician, right? I mean, he was a member of the College of Physicians. It's not that he wasn't a physician. He understood basic medicine, obviously. But it was very bizarre. He said that a couple of my experts, he said that they lack a basic understanding of scientific principles. They don't know what they're talking about. They're fallacious. Basically, like he's accusing them of being stupid. And I'll give you an example of this. So the expert on our side that I haven't mentioned his name, he said, look, here's the statistics for 13 months of COVID deaths. Okay. And here's the car fatality statistics of 2018. And he said, and you can see from one to the other that more people died of car accidents in 2018 than died with COVID, not necessarily of it, in the first 13 months of the pandemic. Okay. Well, the college's expert came in and say, well, you know, this doctor, he's fallacious and he lacks basic understanding of scientific principles, because that's totally wrong. Because he said, you know, by June, there was more people that died. Well, he switched the month from April to June. So again, to get a little nerdy here, if you have like a number and a line and a number, it's called the numerator and the denominator, right? We learned this in grade eight, right? So what this college expert did is he changed the numerator, the number up top, and he didn't change the denominator, right? So like if you do that in grade eight math test, you get that wrong, right? So that's literally the mistake this guy made. And then he accused my expert of being an idiot. My expert came in and said, well, he really made a pretty basic mistake there. He changed the numerator, but didn't change the denominator. And that's why he got that number wrong and made that accusation to me. So what happened when I cross-examined this expert, I brought this to his attention, and then he actually retracted that insult, right? Now, you might miss this if you don't know. It's a big deal when you can get an expert witness to retract something that they've said in a report or in their testimony, because, I mean, it's a really obvious admission that I said something wrong, I said something stupid, I'm trying to take it back, right? Huge damage to credibility, right? It says a lot about the qualifications of credibility and reliability and trustworthiness of the expert. So I got him to retract that. He retracted one other thing too, because in the beginning of his report, he had said, well, you know, masks work great to stop the Manchurian plague. Okay, again, a bit nerdy, but the Manchurian plague was caused by a bacteria. And those of you who don't know, bacteria are hundreds, sometimes thousands of times bigger than viruses. You probably learned this in about grade nine science, not overly technical. We kind of probably all know that. And so, you know, he made an example of how masks worked in a bacterial plague, and so they must work in a viral plague. See that a grade nine student might make, but you know, a public health officer, it's a bit surprising. Anyway, so I brought this to his attention across examination. And even without any questions from me, he retracted that part of his report, right? Because he immediately recognized how absurd what he said, right? And so, you know, without even questioning from me, he retracted it. So twice he retracted things that he had said, either in testimony or in his report, which, you know, as a lawyer, I was just tickled pink when that happened, because I mean, that's kind of the, you know, that's you really hit the goal of a cross-examination if you can get the opposing expert to retract what he said, not simply to like, you know, disagree, but to like retract. So, you know, this point about, and, you know, I've heard this repeatedly, you know, kind of through the grapevine from other lawyers and other people who have watched these proceedings. The general course of things over the last 2 years is that every time the government is challenged and people like me bring in these really good experts like Dr. Bridle to show that everything they're doing is really ridiculous, they bring in really bizarre experts who are quite terrible at defending the government's positions. And yet, sadly, it doesn't seem to matter, because the courts just rule in the government's favor anyways, almost, you know, to spite the evidence or lack thereof, or the quality of the challenger's experts and the lack of quality of the government's experts, right? And it's the same pattern here. I brought in four really good experts. They could only bring in one. And, you know, he was really quite surprisingly unscientific in the way, and I challenge people, you know, to go and read the transcripts. It's available. I'm, you know, this isn't like me just saying this and then nobody gets to read this. They get to read the transcript of everything he had to say when he was questioned by the college's lawyer, and everything he had to say when I cross-examined him. That's probably, you know, if you don't want to read all of these, read that one, because that's probably the most fun one to read, because cross-examinations are probably the funnest part to read. you know, it's the same thing here. And I'll remind people in this case too, this case started in December 2020. Dr. Wall got all of his experts, well, his first three experts in by April 2021. Okay, this case is really old because the college is like, we want to go to a hearing. We want to go to a hearing. He's like, all right, fine. Here's your three experts. And we're supposed to have a hearing in July 2021. And at the last minute, they said, well, we don't have an expert yet, so we're not ready to go. Right? They couldn't find an expert. Well, what does that have to say about all this, right? And I said, all right, fine. Here's a fourth expert. And that's when I brought in Chris Schaefer. You know, and finally we started all this. We started this thing in September 2021 because finally they had their expert, right? Couldn't find one. And then when they found one, he was quite lackluster. I mean, that should tell people a lot right there, right?
It also tells people a lot about the severity of being taken before the college. So now you're talking about a situation. When was Dr. Wall first agitated by his college? When was he first abused by them and first told not to practice, first that suspended?
December 2020, they tried to suspend his license. And again, I'll remind people that that's something that's reserved for when professionals are raping their clients, stealing from their clients, showing up to work drunk, those types of things. There's other examples, obviously, but things of that severity, right? Where they're obviously a harm to their patients and their staff and the public and themselves, right? We suspend their licenses for good reason. That makes sense, right? So that's literally, they took that move.
Which, by the way, all of those are criminal offenses. We've talked about this before, but there's no need for a college to get involved at all. There's no need for a college because if it's criminal behavior, the police can investigate it.
Yeah. Anyways, yeah, so this is December 2020. And so they tried to take away his license on an interim suspended basis. And by the way, if they had succeeded, his license would still be gone because that suspension lasts until the hearing ends, which we're still in, right? And that's not going to end until April, and then we have to wait to get a decision. So thankfully, they, you know, the complaints director wanted this license suspended. This had to go to a third party to make a decision. And I convinced that third party that, you know, look, follow the law, don't suspend his license. And they didn't, right? So that he's been able to practice. This is an interesting point too. He's been able to practice without a mask now for the last, 14 months, 16 months, whatever it's been, right? But he's been practicing without a mask, right? And of course, there hasn't been any harm from that, obviously, right? You know, so this has been ongoing and it was terrible. You know, the month of December 2020, because AHS, Alberta Health Services, shut down his chiropractic office. One of the things I had to do back then was beat down the doors with AHS to get his office back open. So for the whole month of December 2020, right over Christmas, he's got eight kids, this guy. He had no income whatsoever because Alberta Health Services has shut down his office.
Well, that's where I was going with that line of questioning and the fact that this has been over a year and a half, almost 2 year experience for him, probably when the harassment started from the college. Okay, so let's wrap this up, James. I've got two concluding thoughts. And the first is this, folks, James and I are excited. You know, we had this conversation on Monday, said we've got to release the transcripts, get them up on the website. So, you know, www.libertycoalitioncanada.com. If you go to an update on Dr. Wall's case, you're going to skim down and you're going to see a highlighted yellow area. And that is going to be what James has written as an update to the case. And then below that are PDFs. Look, if you've seen James flipping through materials, you've seen James, you know, put his head down and read. If you truly want to investigate the truth, it is a very simple thing. Go and read the transcripts from these expert witnesses. It's going to be convincing. It's going to be helpful. And again, the reason why we wanted to give you this is so you can, this is the beauty of technology. It's a simple copy and paste, put it out on Twitter. Please reference where you got the transcripts, you know, for our benefit. But let's use this information and convince as many people. Like, we're, you know, thankfully the mask mandates ended just a few days ago here in Ontario. Which by the way, we were away for a little while, and you just would not believe how many people were, you know, gobsmacked that we were still wearing masks on our faces. That being said, though, it leads us to the last point. You know, go and use those transcripts. But James, like, what, you know, we're partnering together, Liberty Coalition Canada, and you're a chief litigator. We're working together. We're partnering with these clients. When you and I were on the phone, you said one thing that I want to do is I want to make everybody aware of how much work it takes to kind of run these cases slash, you know, make these types of transcripts available. So I believe we're talking about 1,000 pages of redacted information. That must have been a tremendous amount of work. And again, that is very searchable, folks. You just hit, you know, Control F or Command F, and you can search any PDF for significant words. You can move your research really, really quick. We want you to go to the website and use it. But James, like, this has had to have been a tremendous, this whole case has to be a tremendous amount of work. I want you to comment on that the way that you, of course, were drawing my attention to this at the beginning of the week.
Yeah, I know it's difficult for people to comprehend just how much work goes into this. I'm going to check my hours here. I think it was, I've spent 167 hours of work. Okay, think about that, 167 hours. That's over the course of a year and a bit. And some of that was spent before Liberty Coalition Canada took this case on. That's weeks, Monday to Friday, you know, 8 to 5, working on this same thing over and over and over and over again. That's how it takes. That's how it works. And that's why it's so rare that this type of stuff happens. And that's why I think this is so special and it's so important to get this out, because it does. It takes somebody 167 hours to find experts, review their reports and understand the case and develop a theory of the case. And then, you know, we get the reports in, and then I have to understand all that, and I'm not a scientist. And then I have to, you know, cross-examine all these guys, and I have to go through these 6 days of hearing. And it's an enormous amount of, you know, and I have to spend each time. I mean, I'm getting ready to question these guys. I mean, it's like, you know, 10, 15 hours of prep to understand all this material to be able to question them, right? Or to be able to cross-examine, same thing, right? If it's going to be done right, that's what it takes, right? And it would take, you know, anywhere roughly the same amount of time. It's just the raw work that has to be. You have to synthesize the information. Right. It's very expensive, right? Obviously I'm charging a discount to Liberty Coalition Canada, right? But it's, you know, 167 hours. That's obviously going to be a lot of money. I don't care what your rate is, right? It's a lot of resources to do this. And it's not being done nearly enough in this country. That's one of the reasons why I'm so glad we're doing it. But it is so important to being done. I've told somebody this the other day in an interview with Western Standard. Unfortunately, you cannot maintain a free and democratic society unless you have a small army of civil liberties lawyers who are willing to work for less or for free in order to advance all these cases and constantly hold government accountable. It's just not going to happen, because there's certain things that you can't do through any other institution or any other process than the justice system or the quasi-judicial process of going to a hearing like this, right? I mean, where else would I actually, you know, be in a spot where people were compelled to listen to me question Dr. Bridle for 6 or 7 hours? I can't do that in any other context. I can't do that before Parliament. I can't do that in the public square. I can't do that in the media. You know, I can only do that. Where else can I get a transcript and do this? And the people who are going to make a decision that actually impacts the country have to listen to it, whether they like it or not. It's only through this adversarial judicial or quasi-judicial process, right? And unfortunately, in order to do that and do it right, it takes an enormous amount of resources. And that's what we did here. That's what I set out to do. And, you know, thankfully, through Dr. Wall's bravery and courage and principle, because he's made this happen by his choices and the risks he's taken, and the people who have donated to Liberty Coalition Canada, we've made this possible. Right. And, you know, and through my, you know, I saw this case and I saw what it could be. And I thought, if I got a man who's got the courage and the principle and some people who are willing to pay for it, we can do this. We can mount this, you know, amazing case to show the world that masks don't work and they're harmful. We shouldn't have to, but this is how we have to do it. This is the best way to do it. And we can produce 1,000 pages of transcripts with experts and show the world in a way that you can't do anywhere else how this is done. And so I would encourage people to consider donating to this type of thing, because it takes an enormous amount of resources and it just doesn't happen if people aren't going to make, I mean, you know, do you think Dr. Wall would have had the money to do this? You know, he's a chiropractor. He's not a, you know, world renowned investor making $4 million a year, right? He's an average guy, right? He wouldn't have had the money to do this. This is only made possible by donations.
Yeah. And for that matter, he wouldn't have been working if you hadn't have been involved early on. Without legal representation. So, you know what, folks, James and I were on the phone Mondays. We tend to kind of have our strategy calls on Mondays, just as far as like, where are we going next? And I am, James, I'm just so thankful for you. We could sit and talk about this type of stuff for hours, and you helped me understand the law so well. And the reality of it is, folks, we've got, you know, four cases, you know, right in front of us. We're already engaged in three. I think we have two more that we're taking on. And, you know, that's us being selective. That's us not with just a big pot of money and endless lawyers. That's with your generous donations and James here working really hard and our volunteers. We've got some great volunteers that are helping on these things as well. So look, folks, you know, when James was talking about this 1,000-page manuscript, get people going, you know, read it, use it, you know, and how much labor went into that. It is a sincere ask. Would you consider to, you know, go to libertycoalitioncanada.com, donate? We are not a charity, and that's partly because we do take a stand on legal and different types of advocacy roles. But go and support, because your support will bless directly these types of court cases. And of course, you know, the mechanism of Liberty Coalition Canada is just a little bit bigger than James and the legal side of things. You know, your support goes to help, you know, this type of promotion of good information. It helps us, you know, with all the staff that it takes to do emails and communications, and it goes to help, you know, a number of the churches coordinate to work together. And so, you know, we really appreciate your support, and we need it. So for the bigger organization to flourish, please come and help us. And a great amount of our focus is on partnering with James in these cases. So look, thanks, James. Everybody, you know, enjoy your research this weekend, and really you're going to be shocked at some of these testimonies. Go enjoy them. LibertyCoalitionCanada.com. You can find them there. And of course, James will be keeping people updated. Thanks for taking the time to shoot this today and give us an update. And of course, we'll be praying about the upcoming proceedings. What, just really quickly, what are we looking at in the next few weeks for this case?
April 11th and 12th, we have 2 days of closing argument, which is where I basically get to take all these facts and argue the law and say, look, Dr. Wall didn't do anything wrong.
Okay. And then when do you expect to hear a verdict?
I would say the fall of this year. That's when, okay, I expect a decision. Could come sooner. That's what I expect.
Wow. So again, everybody, look at how long this has been so hard on one chiropractor who decided to take a stand. Support Dr. Wall, support James, support the Liberty Coalition Canada. Thank you so much. James, we'll talk to you later, buddy.
Thanks.
Godspeed with your work.